I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. You're listening to the podcast version of the show, which airs every Monday at 2 p.m. on the Radiator 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with short story writer and novelist Moira Crone. Born and raised in Goldsboro, North Carolina, a small town in tobacco country, Moira Crone left at 17 to attend UNC and Smith College and later studied writing at Johns Hopkins University. In 2009, she received the Robert Penn Warren Award for Fiction from the Fellowship of Southern Writers for the body of her work. In 2012, her novel The Not Yet, which is the book we discuss in this interview, was shortlisted for the Philip K. Dick Award for Paperback Original Science Fiction Novel of the Year. After spending her early adulthood in Boston and Baltimore, Moira Crone moved to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and lived there from 1981 through 1995. Since, she has lived in New Orleans. In addition to The Not Yet, her publications include What Gets Into Us, Dream State, A Period of Confinement, and The Winnebago Mysteries and Other Stories. Her works, both fiction and nonfiction, have been published in numerous magazines, including The New Yorker, Mademoiselle, North American Review, Plowshares, Southern Review, The Oxford American, and Working Mother, among others. She's been included in several anthologies. Her stories have been chosen for the year's best by the award anthology New Stories from the South 5 times. She's been selected for an individual artist's grant from the National Endowment for the Arts and a fellowship at the Mary Ingraham Bunting Institute of Radcliffe College at Harvard. She won the Pirates Alley Faulkner Society Short Story Prize in 1994 and William Faulkner Wisdom Award for novella in 2004. She won an Atlas grant from the state of Louisiana in 2005-2006. She's been named Image Journal's Artist of the Month. Moira Crone taught in the MFA program in creative writing at Louisiana State University for several years. She directed the program from 1997 through 2002. She's also taught at Hopkins and Goucher College and is on the faculty of the Prague Summer Program in the Czech Republic. In 2010, she led a workshop as part of the Low Residency Creative Writing Program at the University of New Orleans in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico. She's been a guest artist and teacher at Image Journal's Glenn Workshops and at the University of Missouri's Center for the Literary Arts, and has appeared at the International Conference on the Short Story in English as a speaker, teacher, critic, and artist. In 2010, she was the plenary speaker at the ADEAN Conference, Spanish Association for Anglo-American Studies, in Almería, Spain. The mother of 2 daughters, Anya and Kezia, she's married to the writer, poet, and therapist, Roger Kamenetz. Here's a brief introduction to The Not Yet. It's 2121. The heirs control society's resources from their lavish walled city-states. Through life extension, they live hundreds of years. Outside, the poor barely survive. Malcolm de Lazarus, 20, is a not yet, one counting on joining the elite. But when his fortune mysteriously disappears, he must sail to the chaotic New Orleans islands for answers. On the way, he encounters the darkest side of heir's privilege, which threatens everything he knows and loves. The Not Yet has been selected as one of the best books of 2012. NOLA.com named it one of the top 10 books of 2012, and as I mentioned a minute ago, The Not Yet has been named as one of the 7 nominations for the Philip K. Dick Award, which I believe will be announced later this month. When I spoke to Moira Crone last week, I began by asking if she developed the speculative fictional world of The Not Yet before writing the story, or if that world developed as she wrote the narrative alongside it.
I think in the case of The Not Yet, I developed the world as I was trying to figure out what the narrative was going to be. So I guess once I started the book, I realized that I had to describe a lot of things and I had to think about the ramifications of a lot of the elements that I had created, like the idea that very wealthy people could live on life extension for a long period of time, hundreds of years even. So I had to think about the world before I could have an actor moving through it, because I had to figure out what it was.
Yeah.
In the case of realistic fiction, it's less of an issue.
Sure, because we already live in this world.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that I was writing a long narrative. Now I am, but it's based on a story that I wrote some years ago, and that's about the North Carolina in the 50s, a small town where I was raised. And I had to create that world from the eyes of a child as the child moved through it. I had to sort of, you know, recreate how people existed in that time and how how it was different. So I guess that the world, and in some cases it's simultaneous, in some cases I have to catch up.
Right.
In the case of the speculative world of the Not Yet, I had to catch up. After about 100 pages, I realized I had to figure out every single possible root causes of the things in the world so that I could understand how people would act in it.
Yeah. Right. I found it to be very, very interesting, very strange, but also believable. You know, it's a world that you can imagine happening, and yet it's very upsetting in certain ways, you know, the idea that this would actually happen. And I'll just say that the heirs are sort of like the 1% in our world. They can buy almost immortality or near immortality.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, that is true. Yeah, I mean, I think that I started the book way back. I first published parts of this book in 1999, then 2000. And at that time, this issue of the gap between rich and poor, something was on my mind, but it wasn't broadly discussed in politics at that time, you know, 13 years ago. So it's interesting that it's come now to be a more prominent idea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and the other thing that I found really interesting was the fact that they sort of physically remove themselves from the world of the poor, you know, and the mortals. They kind of create a physical boundary between themselves in some ways. And another aspect of it is that they have rejobs where biological skins are actually fitted on top of their skin, which would become more sensitive to ultraviolet light and would age, I suppose. I wondered if it was at all nerve-wracking for you to write this speculative fiction. Was this something that you found exciting and fun, or was it a little bit nerve-wracking or frightening?
I see. Well, I can understand what you're saying. I think I just was sort of, I guess it is, you know, I can see how it is upsetting, especially the scene where there's a character who wants her skin removed.
Yeah.
And I think that is a very dark scene. Very dark.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a nightmarish situation at all. I think for whatever reason, this stuff came to me rather, you know, just, I had to think about it and I had to think about it pretty hard, you know, to sort of create it all, but it didn't upset me. No, it wasn't like nightmarish for me, but I guess it's dark for people.
Oh yeah.
You know, a lot of dystopian work has this feature.
Yeah, no, I guess I mean that it was a little different from the work you'd done before. And was that nerve-wracking for you? Like, was it stepping outside at all of your comfort zone to write this book, or was it exciting and different?
Oh, I see. It started with a dream, and I, you know, had been writing I'd written a book of stories that had done pretty well called Dream State, which is set in Louisiana in the 90s, and I'd published before a novel. And this was like a realistic, I mean, non-realistic thing that I just tried. It was just something I did, sort of wrote it rapidly, sort of out of a dream for the first 80 or so pages. And I was encouraged to continue because a literary review here wanted to serialize the book. They were very interested in it. And they had a lot of letters about it. And at a certain point, it became nerve-wracking because I lost my nerve. I realized that I didn't really know what this world was like.
Yeah.
So after 80 pages, I had to stop and figure out where I was going.
Yeah.
And so then it was a matter of trying to get it right and then having the character move through the world in a way that was, you know, where his motivations were clearly understood.
Yeah. Yeah. Where did it first appear that they would have seen it?
In the New Orleans Review, which is a quarterly at Loyola University, right uptown. And And then it's funny because after the storm, parts of the book, which I had written, were reprinted in Slate at one point, a little piece of it. And they all thought that it was descriptions of Katrina. but had written all that material long before, like 5 years before.
That is so interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Although before Katrina, there were always the threats of hurricanes and the concerns about a hurricane coming up the Mississippi. So I'm sure people had thought about this stuff before, but not like that.
No, but a lot of I had had students and I had, you know, fellow writers write scenarios that were considered at that time surreal about or dream sequences where people were, living in a world in New Orleans in boats.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of thing was something that was in the subconscious of a lot of people.
Right.
I can tell you at least five instances or four instances where students of mine or students that published their stories had that kind of scenario. You know, so I think it was in the subconscious of people that it could happen. I personally wasn't that aware of how threatened we were by the canals, by the outflow canals from the Contra train or any of that. You know,
right.
I didn't even know where they were. I didn't know the geography of the city well enough to really understand what the impact of the storm would be.
Now, where did you live in 2005?
I live very near Tulane.
Okay, so you were in New Orleans at that time.
Well, I was a resident of New Orleans, but I was actually taking my daughter to college in New England on the weekend of this storm.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so she was
wow.
starting college and. We took her up there with we didn't have any clothing, actually. We called JetBlue at the last minute, and they said that we could take 7 bags. This is the difference between those days and these days.
Yeah,
for
right.
free. They were going to let us take them all for free, so we didn't UPS anything. We took everything in bags at the end because it was more convenient.
Yeah.
So we didn't even have a backpack. I was like going to spend 2 nights in New Haven and then come home. That was the plan.
Wow. Yeah.
And,
so how long did you stay away then?
It was a very long saga, and the book
okay.
was actually involved in it, but first we went to New York, then we went to, we were away. I didn't actually see my house until September 15th.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't actually move back to the city until about October 4th.
I'm trying to remember, the storm happened...
August 29th, 2005.
So over 2 weeks.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, and I stayed in about 5 different places during that time. It's extremely trying.
Yeah, I bet.
It was sort of, it's the most maddening and strange thing I've ever seen. It was like existing in a dystopian novel.
Yeah.
You know.
When you left to take your daughter to school, had they already started evacuating the city?
No. She was already up there, which was a godsend in a way. She was on one of these early freshman things where
okay.
they go hike. She was hiking in Vermont, actually. And so we were just the, you know, take the schleppers. We were taking her stuff up there. That's all we were doing. And, you know, spending one night and helping her buy furniture for her new place and bring all her linens and books and, you know, clothing and everything. They had said that it was going to go to Coral Gables, Florida.
Yeah.
That was the thought on the Thursday before the Monday that it hit. So we got on the plane. We weren't paying any more attention because we had to repack everything. So we got on the plane Friday night, and I guess we were there Saturday, and then Sunday, we realized we couldn't go home.
Yeah.
But we had about an hour or two. We would have landed, and then the county, the parish that we were landing in, was closed. So the first question was, well, if the city is closed to us by then because of, you know, they're closing down and creating a contraflow so that all the traffic would go outflow, then the airport would have closed. We didn't really, it was a little ambiguous. We may have gotten in that night, but the next morning the city was closed. And we figured it would be easier to stay out of it all than to be caught in that traffic in one direction or the other. So we stayed in New England one more night, and then we went to New York and the storm hit.
Yeah, my goodness.
Yeah, well, I remember I was in Phelps Gate, and a friend of mine called. This is like the gate at the freshman dorms at Yale. And
okay.
she said, I just talked to the mayor. I'm leaving now in a convoy going north with my friends to Memphis. And now I'm going to go throw up. And they had just heard from the mayor, she said. You know, the mayor was on the radio. Finally,
oh
that morning,
God.
He evacuated. It was only 20 hours before the storm came in, and he evacuated the city.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. The next seven days was terrifying.
Did you have pets?
Yes, we had a dog, China, and she was living in a cage in the veteran. You know, she was in a kennel. You know, she's a kennel, and but run by a vet.
And so she was in a safe place.
No, the vet called us, and he said, and on Saturday he said, "I'm not going to let her dry on the cage because we didn't have anybody to take her from the place when they closed it down in the city." So he came across the lake and retrieved her and took her to the North Shore, and we didn't find her until October.
Oh my goodness!
Because she was. They didn't have any telephones, and, you know, it was really hard to... The North Shore was in terrible condition as far as trees down, and nobody... People didn't have power for months.
Yeah.
And she had this whole other life. He took a lot of animals in, and he was in a house on stilts. And there was a woman who was in hospice care in his house, and she became like the companion dog for her.
Wow. You know, it's amazing. There are so many people who behaved like heroes. You hear a lot about the people who kind of behaved poorly during the storm, but there are so many heroes too. I mean, just thinking about what that vet did, and he's just one of so many who did things like that.
Oh yeah, and it was amazing, and it was amazing, and everybody had that impulse afterwards. Enormous amount of goodwill to help others, you know, and just be generous. I mean, people just started this kind of like generosity campaign in terms of like, well, we're neighbors and we have these mutual threats and we just really can't ignore each other. We have to be friends. We have to help each other.
Right.
You know, and that's sort of an ethos that's remained in the city, I'd say, afterwards.
Yeah. Now, you said that you had done a lot of writing on this book already before Katrina, but that must have really energized you toward continuing with this project. Is that true?
Well, it's funny because this is the truth. I was on a grant to finish the book from the state of Louisiana, and it's called an Atlas Grant, and it started the day, that week of Katrina, the same week. That was the
grant. Oh, my goodness.
At that time, the first line of the book was, "In my 21st year, I was called back to the ruins of New Orleans."
Oh, my God.
And so it seemed...
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it was. And it seemed very prescient and a little spooky, actually.
Yeah.
And because I had already written all the descriptions of riding through the city underwater and the descriptions of and sort of Venice-like islands and all of that. It did seem a little spooky. I did work on the book that year, which was a way to sort of get through what was happening, because it was a very... I just think, in a way, I'm a kind of person who, given that kind of traumatic situation, tends to, need something to concentrate on, sort of keep my grounding, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that, and also, you know, did things, other things, the kind of things people in the city were doing for each other, you know, to some degree, and I worked on the book, and I think that actually when we first sent it out, I think people thought that it was about Katrina and that it was a very political book. They didn't get the book because they saw it through the lens of Katrina.
Huh.
And I, in fact, the bookseller here said he thought that that's why it wasn't originally bought, and that people saw it as political and about Katrina.
Which is funny, because in a way it is political, but it's not about Katrina.
No, it is political, but it's not about Katrina. And so But I do think that now I think people, it's settled into the psyche more how the threats to Louisiana are actually the threats to our entire civilization, at least in North America. And in general, you know, a lot of the threats that we're dealing with here, high water, environmental degradation, whether we're not, you know, what kind of community we're going to have, these kinds of things are things that are more national now as concerns. They're more in, it doesn't seem like it's just something that's happening down there, which is how a lot of people like to think about Louisiana.
Yeah, yeah. And the South, I think the South in general, too, don't you?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, people all, I think that there's always been in our American consciousness a northern and a southern view, worldview, and they've obviously come into great, you know, conflict over the years, and the northern psyche sort of thinks that things in the South are a little tainted and not are impure in some way. It's a little puritanical, actually, the way the North looks at the South, and it has that influence of, you know, there's some kind of pure and, you know, mode of valor that is truly Yankee, but not truly entirely, you know, that some parts of the country just haven't caught up. You know? and I do think that that's, you know, part of the American psyche. And I think that New Orleans is absolutely the emblem of the other side. You know, what will happen if everything goes to, you know, where in a handbasket?
Right, right.
But I think if you live on the Jersey Shore, you probably see this differently.
Yeah, I absolutely think that's true. But before the Jersey Shore and before, you know, for example, Irene, which Vermont experienced last
year. Oh,
Lord,
that was a terrible thing, yeah.
But before these other storms, do you think Katrina helped bring our country together a little bit more than it had been or not?
Well, at first there was an enormous amount of anger as if it were New Orleans' fault that this had happened, when all the super infrastructure that was faulty was built by the Army Corps of Engineers. They were not allowed in Louisiana to build their own levees in a lot of circumstances.
Oh.
You see what I mean? This was all built by the America. It wasn't built by Louisiana.
Right,
it wasn't
right.
well maintained because we don't have a very strong voice in Congress. You know, we don't.
Yeah.
We did at one time, but we haven't had very, you know, powerful legislators. I do think that the plight, or the fact that America is not absolutely, you know, the best at everything, which is the way Americans like to think of themselves, and they have thought that way since the Second World War, you know, that other countries do these things better, that other countries actually came here and helped us, you know, and Louisiana was, you know, a point around the globe of, you know, empathy and concern. You know, I think those things really made America look at itself differently, and possibly the issues of infrastructure, of the gap between rich and poor, of the social safety net, of what the emergency management FEMA really should do and how it should be done, how it should be managed, you know, what people expect of the government. I think there has been some change. I don't think the change has been entire yet.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think we're in a... I mean, my historical view is that it's not dissimilar from what happened in the Great Flood of 1927, where the whole country had to come together, and an American Red Cross and Hoover became prominent for a short period, and actually that was how he became elected president, was because of his actions during the Great Flood, which is a Mississippi crisis. You know, it was a crisis in this, not in the New Orleans area and also above us in the Delta. And then you had this crisis, and then the country collapsed financially. These things happened in a certain sequence, and in a kind of slow motion, the same things happened again.
Yeah,
you know? And we have gone to the left, which is what happened when Roosevelt was, you know, these things sort of happened in a similar... We even now have the Dust Bowl thing. In other words, we're having this problem of drought in the Midwest. So it's sort of a repeat in a way. It's strange.
All right, so I'm just sitting here thinking, okay, now her book is not about Katrina. I'm not going to make her talk about Katrina through the whole interview.
No, but I do think it's an interesting thing, and I think Katrina changed New Orleans also, and Katrina made New Orleans a place where this book has been received very well in the city, especially by the younger people. That's been very interesting.
Yeah. I want to talk too about maybe in a little while, not quite yet, but the art show that came out of this, which I just thought was amazing.
I know, isn't that great?
It is. It's great. But first, I thought right now, before we talk more about the book, just to have a sense of the book, I'm wondering if you would mind reading a couple pages.
Okay. First and last, but not yet. Malcolm, I've called you in to tell you how things are. My guardian began in that voice they all had, full of sizzle, like a rattle. His eyes didn't blink, I noticed. I sat in front of him on a bench with a thick cushion and fat legs, my feet not touching the floor. It was his office in the old Audubon Foundling House on the islands of New Orleans. The lit sconces with half shades above our heads were giant fireflies to me. I asked them for help, maybe for strength. Could I be strong? I didn't know. This was the first time Lazarus had ever summoned me. I was only 5, and I was shivering. At dawn, the cook, Mary Lee, had awakened me with news of this meeting, said I needed to get ready. Instead of breakfast, she had made me drink a tumbler full of something foamy and yellow, which tasted like chalk. Half an hour later, my stomach exploded, 15 runs to the bucket. She said that got rid of the worms. In the gardens, she poured kerosene on my head, and then a strange green oil. After, in the sunlight on the banks of the old river, she combed out my nits. Finally, she led me to a room with a large stainless steel tub on a pedestal. It was a shock. I was used to being hosed down. She scrubbed me with stinky pine soap, washed my hair and rinsed it twice, lifted me out in a fluffy towel, gave me new clothes, which made me very proud, a collarless shirt and thin pants that fell past my knees. She sent me down to the hall to my guardian's office with my head still wet. Lazarus noticed my teeth chattering. "I trust your ablutions were not too taxing," he said. I didn't know how to answer. That Marilee was gentle. He leaned back and the slow, thick features of his padded face closed in. He was round-shouldered with a big head. His hands were small. I stared at him and failed to speak. "She praised you, said you were quite the little stoic, the silent type." He took a very long pause. "My friend Ariel had told me, you always have to wait when you talk to them. They're slow on purpose to drive us crazy. So, to begin, there are two kinds in this world, the lucky and the unlucky. The lucky have a trust. If you don't build one, you will have a hard life, and it'll end like..." He tried to snap his fingers, but he couldn't. His overskin was too slick for that. For some reason, he looked surprised. "Do you know what I mean when I say end? Do you know about the unlucky? What happens to them? You were supposed to say, the unlucky do the so long goodbye. But the rough boys in the play yard chanted, they dribble down the drain, they suck the black. It was the most dirty, awful thing that could happen. I know, was the first phrase I uttered, and it will never happen to me. Lazarus was pleased. Now we can dream, the wise men say, but we can't observe eternity. So we shouldn't say never, but we can say not for a very long time, a very long... Never, I tossed my head, which I knew he'd like. That's the spirit. That's the promise of the reveal, which is so far being kept. We aren't supposed to tell our counts, but I'll do it. I'm approaching 200. Do you realize how long that is? He smiled, bluish teeth. And this is all you have to know for now. There are two kinds in this world, those who are certain they will not last, and those with wonderful lives and every reason to hope for eternity, like me. We are heirs, for slang, tees, for treated. Now, we don't insult the unfortunates by calling them dirty, low naturals or naps or loans. We use their enclave names, freewheelers, chef Manturians, port grammarsarians, and so on. Why add to their misery with cruel epithets? I didn't know what epithets were. And those with hope, like me, are the treated ones. We don't have to do that dirty, awful thing, at least not any time soon. His laugh was a gush. We prefer to be called heirs. The only difference between naps and heirs is the trust. To be an heir, you must be treated, and to be treated, you need a trust. Money. And it's best to start building one as soon as you can. His face widened. I brought you in to say that you can begin today. The scouts from Celebration Sims have picked you out. You have a role already. That's why we've cleaned you up. A marvelous opportunity. Don't let yourself down. Don't let us down. Just outside footsteps, Lazarus looked up. Come in. When the door opened, a large man was standing there in a pale green cloud of a suit. He was fair-skinned with a black mustache. I wasn't sure if he were an heir or not. I'd only seen a few. But when he came in and squatted down and touched my shoulder, I knew. Malcolm, the stranger said, his voice deep. I'm Jeremy. How are you? He was at my level and a little hilarious. Besides the mustache, two very thick eyebrows made a big M at the top of his face. His dark hair was thick and short. He looked up at Lazarus. Oh, my, where do you get these gems? So fresh. Still wet from his bath. Delightful. Look at the bones, a little pretty lip. Returning to me, he added, ready for adventure? I nodded yes, though I wasn't sure. You have to speak, he said. Speak, boy, Lazarus commanded. Yes, I said in my normal tone. But I saw they wanted more, so I took a deep breath and shouted, yes, adventure. I was eager to please. Oh, my, Jeremy said, with a grin that straightened his mustache. Lungs, very useful. Lazarus finally came out in front of his desk and stood quite close to me. I was thrilled to be so near him. He was a sort of father in my dreams, though I knew in truth I was fatherless. He leaned in for a moment and cleared his throat. He was about to get what my mate Ariel called the speech. Now, dear boy, so far you have been very brave, but there is more to endure. At times the contrast between this place and the world of heirs will make you consider your life here one of suffering. The things you have to do to add to your trust may seem very hard. You will struggle, But the good news is you will have years, decades, centuries to iron out any wrinkles and bend any kinks. We have marvelous therapies for you once you're one of us. Intricate, sublime. We have implants, extracts, reprogramming, re-description. Everything that happens to you out there can be cured. I've done it. You can too. This is all prologue. This is all just your prologue. Prologue, I eventually decided, meant you weren't supposed to live now so you could live later when you deserved it. I have it here. I hope it's the right side, Jeremy said, bringing out a thin silver ring with a figure eight lying on its side in the middle. This is your not yet collar. Some people say yet. It's short for not yet treated. It says you have a chance. You're ahead of the rabble. He opened the clamp, put it round my neck, and closed it again. Then he threw back his head so I saw his, a black greenish line with a squiggle in the middle, digging into his Adam's apple. See? The same. When you're 20, you get a new one at your boundary time. You dedicate, become confirmed. Then you're on your way, just like me. Lazarus hovered a few inches away. First day on the job, he stepped back so Jeremy could take my hand. As I was marched off, I distinctly remember wanting Lazarus to hug me. And I already knew how very wrong it was to want such things.
Thank you so much for reading that.
Okay.
I'll just mention that's Moira Crone reading from The Not Yet, which is published by University of New Orleans Press. I really enjoyed that opening, and I wanted to ask you why you decided that you wanted to put that opening there. It obviously explains a lot about his situation, and it takes place in a little bit earlier than the rest of the book because he's very young and he's being introduced to all of this. So did you go back and forth about how you were going to start the book, or did you always know that that would be how it began?
Well, that was one of the first scenes that I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
But I had many different openings for the book, and because it has both the history of his childhood and the history of his current predicament, which is a trip he takes back to see Lazarus because Lazarus somehow had money that he's raised as he worked as a child, and when he turns 20, he finds out that his money to be treated, which he's planning to spend in a few years, has been put in escrow, and Lazarus is the guardian of his trust, so Lazarus is the person he needs to ask what happened to the money.
Right.
So he's traveling back. So I did have a lot of questions in my mind about starting the book. So like a lot of writers, I started the book in more than one place.
Yeah, yeah.
I started it over when he wakes up from his from having been assaulted on this trip. He goes to a town called Port Gramercy, and the next scene is he's been assaulted by a group of ruffians.
Yeah.
And they tried to kill him. So that's where I started the book. And for a long time, the book started at a page number now, which would be about page 220 now in the book, which is when he first went to Port Gramercy. That's when that scene is first described.
Okay.
So I think the book is like a circle or a cycle, and, you know, sometimes it's hard to figure out exactly where to start.
Yeah. Personally, I was glad for this opening just because it grounds us in a world that we're very, you know, we're not going to be familiar with because it's all new. So that's helpful. My writing group has been having an ongoing discussion recently about prologues and when is a prologue necessary and when should you call it a prologue or when should you just give it a title, you know, which is what you actually did here by calling it, was it first and last?
Oh, first and last, yeah. You know, I think when you begin a book, you're casting a kind of web, you know, and you're creating certain points that are solid and a lot of points that are very vague or not filled in, which are sort of like describing a field where the reader's going to read on to fill in.
Place.
And that was what I was trying to do there in the first two chapters.
Okay. All right. Great. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the buildup of tension in a novel. You know, early on in this book, as we're getting to know the characters, there's Ariel and there's a character named O. There's Lazarus, who we've just met, and Malcolm, who we've just met. There are issues of loyalties and trust, and very quickly we understand that there may be some questions around these loyalties and who can actually trust whom. So just that buildup of tension, how might you describe writing that or approaching that?
Well, I think that when you have a longer narrative, it's very important to figure out what the reason is that a person, what's the reader reading on to find out.
Mm-hmm.
And in a shorter narrative, just the beauty of the language or just the fact that there's some level of conflict or dissonance can be enough.
Mm-hmm.
But in a longer piece, you need to come up with what is the reader reading on to find out. And simply, in part, this was a discovery for me because I've never written anything like this. And I think the length created for me the anxiety, well, how am I going to make people interested to find out what happens next? And because I'm mostly a short story writer, that's what I've mostly done in my life. So
mm-hmm.
I created, when I got to the point where I knew that Malcolm had a question in his mind and he was trying to get an answer, and it's essential to his existence, what was he going to do? Since he'd been prepared all his life to build up a trust and become treated, what was he going to do if that wasn't going to work out?
Right.
Or how was he going to find out who was against him, who had taken his funds? So that seemed like a pretty good place to pull the person through the book. It ends up being, and I think this is often the case, a question that is not, It's aligned with the real discoveries in the novel, but it is not the real discovery in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's contributory, but it's only on a very sort of topical level. This, you know, so the real discoveries in the novel are about what Malcolm finds out about himself and what he really wants.
Right, which is something that he and the reader both are ignorant of at the beginning, that question even exists. And so having this other question to focus on is useful.
Yeah. And I think that that's how I think a lot of books are created that way. You know, the main character is seeking a answer to a question, you know, and along the way he stumbles upon a whole lot more about his own identity or, you know, what has formed him.
Yeah.
You know, and so, I mean, that is a very, I mean, a young man said to me, well, this, he said, well, let's talk about this book. It's really Oedipus. And, you know, Oedipus doesn't know what's what, you know,
right,
and then he's stumbling through his world and then he makes discoveries. And so I guess, you know, that is a classic way that things can go. There's a question, but it's not the main question.
Yeah.
It's just the one that gets us going.
Yeah. I'm wondering how you go about researching the world as it exists to write a world that might exist, if that makes sense.
Oh, I see, yeah. Well, I think dystopian writers do this a lot. You know, the ways that I think a person who was, if one were going to write a dystopian or speculative novel, first thing you'd probably want to do is read Scientific American.
Yeah.
And because actually what a lot of, which I've learned now because I've gone to some science fiction conventions, I'm getting ready to go to a big one in Seattle, NorwestCon. A lot of what science fiction writers do, and this is a little different than what I was doing here because mine is more social, but is that they provide a kind of like field of thought experiment for people who are in these worlds, actually. You know, who are trying to figure out, you know, what it would be like if cars drove themselves, for
mm-hmm.
example, or what it would be like if, what would be the ramifications of more life extension, which a lot of people from bioethicists to everybody else are trying to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
And also people are trying to do, you know, figure out how we're going to give social and, you know, medical insurance to people that live forever.
Yeah, you know? Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of work being done by people who write speculative fiction of every kind that's actually useful to people who, engineers.
Mm.
Like, I know, for example, my son-in-law is an engineer at Google, and I was at a science fiction convention, and the guy who came up with the idea of the singularity, Vern Novinga, who's a physicist and a brilliant thinker, I started texting my son-in-law, what would you like me to ask him?
Yeah.
And in fact, he's been hired by Google at various times to help them with their thought experiments. Because they're doing things that are going to change the way people communicate in every way. you know, and a lot of other things. Google are doing a lot of things, you know. So it's interesting, you know, you asked me, I think reading scientific, in the case of this book, I read a little bit about life extension, you know, scenarios, what people have come up with, why people age.
Right.
The telomeres are important. Starving people is really important. Like if you starve mice, they live three times as long.
Right. I remember there was a Scientific American article about that. And actually, I think they were talking about fish, too, just sort of the longevity of fish that had eaten less, I guess.
Yeah. And there are people, you know, there's a group of people who live on around 900 calories a day who are trying to extend their lives that way.
Wow. I wouldn't want to be them.
No, and they have 900, whatever they've come up with, and they, you know, have very low body fat, and they have problems, you know, they have a lot of different problems. Irritability, their bones hurt, you know, because they don't have any flesh.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they're living longer, but there are people who are trying to experiment with life, you know, life extension through calorie restriction. And then there's certainly a lot of people trying to do life extension through various other means. And so you can read about what they want to say and how they view it. And there's an entire group called the transhumanists who want to imagine that human beings will evolve or by technology, you know, go past our current physical limitations of every kind.
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing a lot of thought experiments about that.
Now, I'm wondering if in your research you discovered that living a long, 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 long time, that the skin would be the thing that would really suffer, and that's why you invented this rejobs and overskins and things. Is that something that you found in your research, or is that something you just came up with?
I came up with that.
You came up with
that. I see that, you know, people who are aged, you know, or if they were in the public eye, they stuff themselves with collagen, you know,
mm-hmm.
and their faces start to look like masks.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and so I guess that was an issue that occurred to me, you know. I mean, that was sort of what I was commenting on or looking at.
Yeah.
But, I do think the skin would really be the thing that you would want to work on because it's a huge organ and it would be taking a real beating.
Right, it's right out there.
Yeah.
Speaking of rejobs, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about inventing the vocabulary of a fictional universe. So you've got the not-yets and the gnats, and the not-yets are also called the nyets, the rejobs and the skins. And I just, you know, that must have been kind of fun, coming up with the vocabulary. Is that...
Yeah, it was. And I did think was that somehow, as with the way jargon is in from a certain era, that there was a certain, you know, group of principles around which the jargon or the new language would be formed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like in certain eras, we've taken words from certain languages, you know, and like that. In other words, I had sort of a principle that it would be sort of clunky and, you know, just new compound words from simple English words. Those are the things that those are the principles that I followed,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess they all have certain common roots in a certain kind of, you know, simple Anglo-Saxon kind of root language. None of them are real, except telomeron which is the name of a drug. That comes from the term, the term for the telomeres, which are parts of the cell that deteriorate in aging.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think in general the language that I used was from a certain kind of common root, you know.
Yeah.
And clunky and kind of ugly. And I thought that would be, because they're in a world of a different kind of, and I would feel deteriorated aesthetics.
Yeah.
The aesthetics have been quite deteriorated.
Which I think happens, too, when you have, you know, increased stratification of society, you know, where there's just a lot of, there's a lot of angry language, and that comes into the common language.
Yes, I think you're right. And I think that it's interesting to look at when there's a huge gap between rich and poor, what effect does this have upon the aesthetic standards and the ability to have a shared cultural, expression.
Yeah.
And I did think the one thing I did think was that the heirs had very poor taste. You know, and in general, their taste, like when you describe the operas that they go to and what entertains them, I wanted that to seem that they had very bad taste.
Yeah, they're very they're kind of over the top.
Yeah, and then they their bathos, and it was big for them. And mm-hmm. I felt like I guess that came into the language too. In other words, there was an aesthetics. I mean, I'm not saying this is negative or positive, but their idea of the highest form of art, the way we feel about opera, is Disney films.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about that a lot. The Disneys are like the highest cultural icon.
Yeah.
And in fact, some Disney films do deserve that status, like opera, I suppose. I mean, they do in my mind. Aladdin, for example.
Yeah.
That is the highest thing. The highest thing you could possibly know would be, you know, the songs to Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo, like really up there, you know? And that was something that I did directly because I wanted to feel, I wanted to have that crudity of their aesthetic choices.
Right. Well, one thing that was wonderful in the book was the way, you know, the way Malcolm is raised by the heirs, and so he's infused with their ethics and their choices, and so he grows up feeling like these plays that they put on that depict death, and it's just an incredibly popular form of entertainment for the heirs. He sees that as all very serious, but in the wrong way, in a strange kind of twisted way, and I enjoyed that.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah. Yeah, that was something I thought about, was what they would be like culturally.
Yeah.
I did think about that. And in a way, it was a most, I'd say, the most satirical or, it was surreal, actually. I thought about Brunel a little bit.
Yeah.
Brunel film.
Yeah,
you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And they call death the so long, which I liked. That's, again, back to the vocabulary, the so long.
Yeah. I'm glad you liked that because that was something I did think about. And I had a lot of, those things were a lot of fun.
Yeah. That was fun to read. Speaking of reading, do you mind if I read a paragraph from the book?
No.
It's a scene that takes place from Malcolm's point of view in the curing towers. So this is in his voice. I imagined the thin film, the mirror surface of the sea of Pontchartrain I had noticed on the ride over on the sky rail. I knew that there were lost towns underneath the sea that had lined the northern shore and the eastern edge of the old lakes, the Pontchartrain and the Maurepas, before they spread into a single sea after the lands were lost and the Mississippi changed course. On cloudy days, I'd seen floating lampposts under the surface, wrecked ancient cars, broken streets, the ridge pieces of old roofs. When the sun shone this morning as I was coming over, though, all I could take in was the shining surface. That was just one of so many paragraphs I could have read to talk about place in this book and the beauty that you use to describe this kind of tragic landscape. And one thing that was really interesting was the fact that a lot of the places in the book are based on actual places re-envisioned in this dystopian future. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the place in this book and writing it without the benefit of something real to look at and describe, but having to sort of imagine it into this future.
Ah, yes. Well, I think that the place is very rich in this book, and I couldn't really have... a book with the same themes could have been written elsewhere, could have been set elsewhere or nowhere. But the fact that it's in New Orleans... really had a lot of meaning for me. Although after Katrina, I had to rethink it because Katrina changed, I mean, the way that New Orleans was seen in the American psyche. And I think that's something that's ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And New Orleans is seen very differently now by American consciousness. And I think my vision of this book was a little bit more like the way Beasts of the Southern Wild sees this landscape.
Mm. I haven't seen that yet.
So. Yeah, well, that's a book about, you know, that's a film about, you know, these lost lands. And in fact, there are places south of the city that are being ravaged by sea level rise and by the way that the marshes have been cut up because of oil exploration and the marshes are disappearing for reasons that are man-made, as well as the fact the sea is rising itself. And that's a part of the subject of the Beast of the Southern Wild. There's a very threatened community. That is an actual community, Ile Saint-Cécile, Jean-Charles, which is, I mean, there are places now that used to be regular towns, and now to get to them you have to go on a road that's been created out of limestone, and you're riding through what used to be fields, and now it's open sea. This happens all the time in South Louisiana now, if you get the picture of what I'm trying to mean. Like, there's all these places that are just, you know, and they're up on stilts. Some of them are 20 feet in the air.
Yeah.
The whole town has been raised up on telephone poles, and people live in trailers that they put there with cranes on top of telephone poles.
How do they, I mean, and they have ladders and staircases?
They have staircases, and there'll be a main road that still exists, and then some people live in, you know, these little rickety bridges that go to their tiny piece of land that still exists. But they're surrounded by water where they used to be surrounded by open land. That was low land, you know, but now it's covered.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real but, you know, they still have business there. They're still fishermen, or they're still, you know, working for the oil fields. And so you do see this landscape a lot. And the trees have died, and they're white, because when oak trees die in salt, because of salt and water, they pickle. It's called pickling. So the whole tree just stands there, and it's stark white because it's dyed of salt.
Mm.
And it's amazing. I mean, it's an amazing landscape. There's the photograph on the cover of the book is of these trees.
Okay.
So that, you know, it's so wrought with, you know, fraught with this kind of, you know, meaning and feeling when you see such places. And it is a landscape that's pretty common around here. You don't have to go far from New Orleans to see that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that wasn't something I had to imagine, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, a friend of mine who actually was he's a filmmaker who helped the guy that did Beast of the Southern Wild, sent me to the same places when I was working on this book and said, you better see this. You better see this town. You better see, you know, these places below the town of Chauvin, which is way down there in the marsh.
Mm.
On the way, you know, just look at these places. And actually, I didn't have to make much up about the way that the Chauvinians live, for example, or what their issues are.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
As far as the city, I went to Venice, and I went to the Museum of the History of the City of Venice.
Okay.
And I actually studied those maps and how they built that town, and what it used to look like at the edge of a lagoon, but it had more land around it, and now what it looks like, you know. And that's sort of what New Orleans looks like in the future. And the lakes that are north of New Orleans, Lake Maurepas, Lake Pontchartrain, have become a lagoon. And really the solid land is considered to be north of the city, and in order to get to the city you have to take boats. And that's pretty much the way Venice is.
Yeah.
So I actually looked at that pretty carefully.
Yeah. You know? Oh, I mean, you can tell that.
Yeah. And I thought about also other places in Europe where they've had flooding over centuries, and some places where they have stone houses like Prague, which also has threat from a river. They've actually closed off some of the lower levels of the same house and kept the house. And they've just lived on the upper floors.
It reminded me, too, a little bit of China and how they've changed the way that they dam places and covered up entire cities with water.
Yes. There are actually, I've read also, you know, over the years, descriptions of places that were flooded on purpose because of reservoirs and so forth. And, you know, if you don't go dive those places, you can see a whole town underneath
right.
the level.
Yeah.
And there are places like that in this country I've read about.
Yeah. I wanted to get back to something I mentioned earlier, the Not Yet art show, which has some really interesting depictions of these underwater cityscapes, too. So how did the Not Yet art show come to be? That was wonderful. I'll put a link on the podcast site so people can go look at it.
Oh, great. That's wonderful. My publisher, UNO Press, you know, was working with some people who are very innovative and wanted to find a new way to promote the book. So they took a lot of different passages from the book, And they send out a call to artists all over the world,
literally.
And there are about seven or eight different countries people came to involve.
Yeah.
And there are illustrators from Portugal and Brazil and UK and Poland and Germany and Spain and U.S. from all over. So it's digital. It's a digital art show. It only exists in that form.
Right. Okay.
And so we had an art show at an art gallery where we projected it. You know, we projected the whole show, and I gave a reading, and people could see all the works. And then some people in town also did works that are physical on paper, and they brought those works also, you know, things that had inspired them.
What an innovative idea, and it's so good for everyone. And it was so much fun to look at these pieces that they created.
Yes, and I've corresponded since with some of the people, who also do other things. One of them is a poet. So it's been fun, you know, to get to know these people. And I found it to be just marvelous to look at these images, and it makes me want the book to be made into a graphic novel, which is something I always hoped would happen, but it hasn't happened yet, but I'd love it.
Yeah, I think that would be really neat.
Yeah.
Well, so just a couple last questions. What have you enjoyed reading lately, or who are a few of your favorite authors?
Well, actually, I'm working on a new book now, and the writer that I really love is Peer Peterson, who wrote Out Stealing Horses.
Mm-hmm, right.
I love that book.
That's a wonderful book.
Yeah, and so I've been reading his book, because I'm dealing with an older character who is thinking about things that happened in her youth.
So it's not speculative this time?
Huh?
Not speculative fiction this time.
No, that book is not speculative, no. And then the writers that I love, I've been in the speculative realm. I like Ursula Le Guin, of course.
Yeah.
And I love Octavia Butler. I love the writer Jean Hagelin. She wrote Into the Woods.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, and I love Margaret Atwood, although she doesn't like to be called a sci-fi writer. I read her novel, Handmaid's Tale, several times while I was working on this book. And also Children of Men is a book that I love by P.D. James, much more than any of her mysteries.
Okay.
Yeah, those are some of my speculative writers. I love other people. I love Alan Gurganis's work. He's a North Carolina writer. He's a great short story writer and novelist. Alice Munro, of course.
Oh, yeah. It's so funny because as you've been saying these names, on my desk I have probably a stack of about 10 books, and I got Margaret Atwood here. I've got a couple Alice Munros.
Oh, yeah. Well, I love her. I think she's one of the most mysterious and amazing short story writers. She's very inventive, and her forms are just cannot be. I don't know. They're just so mysterious.
You can't emulate her, can you? She's just her own thing.
Yeah, well, she's just amazing. Yeah. And I love short story. I'm a real fan of short story form, and I think she's just the best.
Yeah. Can you talk a tiny bit more about what you're working on now?
I'm working on a novel. I'm not sure what I'm going to call it. I might call it A Burning in Winter, and I might call it The History of Away.
Mm.
And I don't know which is best.
Oh.
But it's a story about a woman in her 50s who's widowed. And she's in thinking back on things that happened to her in her childhood in the 60s in the South. And what some terrible things that happened to her when she was a child.
Okay. And does it take place in Louisiana or elsewhere?
Well, the scenes take place in North Carolina. Her scene, where she is in the story, is in Florida Panhandle.
Mm-hmm.
On the coast, the Gulf Coast.
Okay.
But most of the novel, 90% of it's going to take place in Eastern North Carolina, where I was raised.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you very much.
That, again, was a conversation with Moira Crone. And you heard that interview thanks to a listener who requested that I try to interview Moira. The listener wrote to me a couple weeks ago and said that she just loves her work and was curious if I might be able to speak with her. And now that I've discovered Moira Crone's work, I love it too. So it's kind of been a great experience all around. You can read more about Moira Crone and her work on her website, moiracrone.com. And you can see the outcomes of the Not Yet Art Show at the website commonfolkcollective.com/blog/category/the not yet. Actually, I think it's the not-yet. But anyway, I'll put a link on the podcast site so that you can find it more easily. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Anne Barbano's The Next Frontier, an issues-oriented program about autism, disabilities, and diagnoses. The Next Frontier can be heard every Thursday at 6 on The Radiator. Recipient of a 2012 Governor's Award, The Next Frontier features local, national, and international guests. You can visit Anne Barbano's The Next Frontier on Facebook and Twitter for updates. So today I have several Write the Book prompts. They were all suggested by my guest, Moira Crone. She offered prompts for conventional fiction and then several for speculative fiction. So here they are. Three prompts for conventional fiction starts. The first one is, after he stopped her from jumping. And then, I remember. The third one is, I will never forget. So use those prompts to start writing something if you're looking to write conventional fiction. If you're looking to write speculative fiction, you can try one of these three prompts. Since there was no more religion, he decided to. And then the second one is, once the sky had smashed into smithereens, she. And then the final one, she read his arm to see where he was headed. Good luck with these exercises, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you're a Facebook user, please like us. And if you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. I've mentioned this before, I am accepting submissions of writing prompt outcomes for possible inclusion on the show. If you used one of the writing prompts and you're happy with something that you wrote after using that, email it to me, and I have submission guidelines on the website. Also, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, if you have a writing prompt to suggest, or if you have a guest that you would like me to try and interview, as has happened to create today's show, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that the station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. Thank you.